episode is brought to you by Slate House Publishing, recorded at Wayne Howard Studios.
How are you guys doing this morning? This is Jeremy, recovering from the holidays still. Jeremy the tolerable. Jeremy the sober. Jeremy the hungover. Like, any of these could be my
Jeremy
nicknames.
Jeremy the lightly caffeinated.
Jeremy the lightly caffeinated. Coming to you from Slate House Publishing presents Lit Bits. See, all I have to do is look at my co-hosts when I say it.
I like that you say the name of the podcast as though it were a location.
I know.
That's really...
Well, Slate House is a location. There is a Slate House.
There is a Slate House. Yes.
Yeah. So if you guys are just joining us, we have been talking about, for our multi-episode season finale, talking about Bram Stoker's Dracula and its impact. So with the first episode, we talked about, before I get into that, I forgot to introduce, like I always do, my co-hosts. So again, I'm Jeremy the Tolerable, and with me as always is Trevor.
I'm Trevor the Lightly Balding.
Okay.
And Curtis the Omniscient.
Curtis the Omniscient.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
He's a lot
That's
more...
good.
I came prepared.
I'll change. I could be Trevor the Rotund.
Trevor the Rotund. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Why are we giving ourselves nicknames? Well, that's because we are entering into the land of nicknames today. Transylvania, which literally translates into the land of nicknames. No, not literally.
I was like, wow. I did not know that.
No, not really. But let's recap real quickly. So we're talking about vampires. We're doing this whole multi-episode arc on Bram Stoker's Dracula and its impact. So the first of this series, we talk about the different kinds of vampires that are found around the world and all through history. We also talked a little bit about Victorian London. Then after that, we got into Bram Stoker's life and how the novel itself became an autobiography of sorts for the aspects of his life, including how sexuality was not just viewed in Victorian London, but also how it was experimented with. So with, like, you know, the Victorian London, Victorianers wanted to, is that?
Victorianers?
Victorian?
The Victorians.
Victorians.
The Victorians.
The victors.
The victors.
I told you guys. I'm hungover. No, I'm not hungover today. I could be hungover today.
We can get you. We can get you there.
We can get me hungover today.
You're full of donuts, and it can feel. It can feel the same as a hangover. Oh,
yeah, yeah, they can be. The Victorians. The Victorians viewed sexuality with some kind of blinders on, but then they. Actually, when it came to the practice of sexuality, they were actually pretty rambunctious. I mean, we talked about how Stoker himself probably died of syphilis.
I feel like there's a reason why the Eyes Wide Shut orgy scene has so much, like, Victorian, like, costumery on. And it's because it's that idea of, like, the super... sexually repressed people.
It's got to happen in a secret place and nobody can show their face.
Exactly. Yeah. In reality are like these crazy hedonists, you know.
But that kind of describes what we learned about Victorian London from the last episodes. That kind of plays into what we're looking at. So we're going the almost exact opposite direction, because as I've postulated from the beginning, like, some scholars will say, oh, it doesn't matter that he referenced the historical Dracula. And I've argued from the beginning that it does matter, because he was originally going to set this character in Syria, much like J. Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla was set in Syria. And when Stoker learned about Romania and about Vlad the Impaler, he decided... fuck that, I am going this whole new direction. And he researched the historical Dracula, and he researched Romanian customs and culture to try and get it as right as he possibly could. So I don't think we can really talk about this novel without talking about the second inspiration for the character of Dracula, the first being Stoker's mentor, Henry Irving, which we talked about again, like, last episode. But probably the most influential part of this character, which would be Vlad the Impaler. So today, folks, we're Fair warning, spoiler alert, this is going to get gruesome. This
I don't
is
know
gonna
why
get...
you guys are shivering. I think Vlad was a pretty upstanding guy. Yeah.
You think he was all right?
Yeah. He was an upstanding guy.
He was an upstanding guy.
It gets worse.
Oh, I'm warning our listeners that might have squeamish stomachs. I can't talk today. Is this
squeamish
a good day
stomachs.
To?
Yeah, well, that's not easy should, to say.
Well, yeah. You skipped your vocal exercise.
Yeah,
all right. I like that. That's your vocal exercise. Yeah. It's just like vowels.
It is. That's all I can do.
Something I noticed about the impaling technique is that he did it for really practical reasons. He didn't have a very large army.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So we're gonna get into all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sorry. I'm rushing in.
No, you're fine. No.
Let's
just,
get to
I
the
wanted,
impaling
just,
already.
Yeah. Let's get to the impaling. That's what our that's like, we've got two bodies of listeners out there. One are like, let's get to the impaling already, and the others are like, oh, I don't know about this.
Oddly enough, the ones that are really ready for the impaling are they're Russian.
So we're going to get to the impaling, but I just wanted to give that kind of brief spoiler kind of warning. You know, this is going to get very, very gruesome.
Nasty.
Very, very quickly, actually.
Don't share this episode with your kids.
Yeah, don't be that. I would say that with most of our episodes, though. Don't be listening to them with your kids.
Share
in
the Clive
car.
Barker
you can't overestimate.
Episode with your children.
This is going to be worse than the Clive Barker episode. For the as skeevy and as disgusting as this Clive Barker episode made you feel, this is going to like be like, hold my beer.
What's really funny is like the Star Wars episode, which should have been our most kid-friendly episode, was the one filled with the most jizz.
Yeah, didn't we say jizz like 8 times?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Anyway.
Yeah, so this is even going to put the Star Wars episode to shame. So
let's go.
Without
right.
further ado,
yeah.
Vlad the Impaler. So, intro. I made this joke how we joked about how my intro is like a Star Wars crawl. Maybe the guys can put like a mock Star Wars theme behind it or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I'll
a long time
out.
Ago in a European, country far.
European version.
Yeah. European
it's
version.
All, it's bagpipes. It's just
bagpipes and accordions.
The Star Wars theme on bagpipes.
That's right. Dude, that would be so great.
I would jump off a building.
We've just invented a new.
All right. A long time ago in a country far, far away. 15th century Europe. Feudalism is the primary form of government, with kings and princes ruling over countries and principalities, and dukes, knights, and, in Eastern Europe, boyars keep the peasantry in check. The plague is running rampant throughout the whole world, taking the lives of the young and old, the rich and poor, male and female alike. No one is safe. Like the phoenix, the Catholic Church has arisen from the ashes of the Roman Empire to form a new kind of kingdom, one founded in religion and not politics. Converting millions and absorbing countless other European local beliefs, the church creates an army where the priests hold as much power as the local royalty. Believing the plague is from God, whole communities rally around the church for survival. On the eastern cusp of the empire, Constantinople is threatening to fall to the Ottomans. After years of Christian crusades attempting to retake the Holy Land, the Turks have pushed back and threatened to finally invade Europe. This is where our story begins.
You know, except for the bits about the Turks trying to retake Europe, that sounds a lot like 2022 so far.
Kind of does. Yeah, it kind of does. There's some parallel images there.
Yeah, there's a plague, like a plague ravaging the place.
Yeah.
We all serve our feudal lords, who in this case are just billionaires.
These poor people. There's a plague. Everybody cram into the church together.
Pray for it to go away. Pray. Bring out the dead.
Gather in as big of a mass as you can and pray.
Yikes. Hey, wait, that's going on in 2021 and 2022 also.
Oh, yeah. Yikes.
So here's the thing to know about Vlad Dracula is that his reign was relatively short, 1456 to 1462, and then briefly in the early 1470s, and then for a few months in the winter of 1476, and that's it. This historical figure who has had probably as much, I don't know, how would you guys characterize him as a political figure, like a historical figure, like as far as fame goes?
I mean, I don't know very much about him except that he was really into violence.
He's still kind of like revered, right? In Romania?
In Romania, he's still revered. I think his name, as far as like fame wise, is up there with some of the more famous political figures throughout history who've had much longer reigns or who've impacted like a much larger geopolitical environment. Like, I feel like if you say, like, Vlad Dracula, people may not know much about him, but it's like, ooh, Dracula, I know this. And it's in part due to the novel, but it's in part, you know, I mean, there have been some movies made about the historical figure. So it's like, the name is at least recognizable. And for somebody with such a short reign, that's pretty amazing that the name is so recognizable.
It's like the Beatles, you know, they were only together for 5 years, but we'll never forget about
yeah,
them, right?
Yeah.
You know, he made an impact with all that, with all that gross shit he did.
You say the Beatles, I say the Monkees. But yeah, it's this.
That's a whole other podcast.
That's another podcast.
Yeah, we've just become a musical podcast.
I mean, I guess if you think, how do you revere a person like Dracula politically? You know, what is it about him that makes them go, yeah, he's our guy?
That's a good question. Is like, do you revere him or do you fear him? Right.
Well, what's, if he's
what
been
is
dead
the difference?
I think with Romania and the way this story plays out, like there's a certain perspective where I don't think it's different. I think it's a little of both. I think people, like, for instance, and I'll get into this a little bit later, but the Germans at the time already had stories about Dracula during his lifetime. So they were already like, and this is like several countries away from Romania, right? This is like deeper into Western Europe. I mean, it's still on the eastern side of things, but it's a little deeper into the West. And the Germans are already spreading tales and stories about him. Some are true, some are embellished, but his name is already getting out there.
So not only did his reign last incredibly a short amount of time, the folklore had already started while he was still
alive and while he was still in power.
That's nuts.
You gotta have a good PR campaign.
He had a great
right?
PR person. Then.
I mean,
just
that's,
guys on horses going
just
like
got, yeah,
everywhere.
Like we had, well, like the U.S. We had Paul Revere. Like the British are coming, and he's got like Vlad. You know, he's got guys on horses doing the same thing. Like Dracula's impaling.
But what was really impressive is that they were, you know, they were ventriloquists. They, you know, severed heads and everything.
But think about this too. Think about this. So like, not only are we talking about like the reason he's revered is because he was a Christian hero. He was repelling, you know, the Crusades had been going on for a long time, and people, like I framed in the intro, had been rallying around the church for a long time. So the church was kind of their whole life. So you have this hero, as gruesome as he is, on the Eastern Front, repelling and chasing off the larger Turkish army and doing what other Christian crusaders were unable to do. I mean, people were cheering him on. They were like, yeah, be as dirty and gruesome as you want to be. You're helping us. You're protecting us. So
it's interesting.
When
you're on the quote unquote right side of the violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
How much of that it seems like it's
maybe
it's
they weren't
smarter.
Maybe they weren't seeing a whole lot of it. Maybe, you know, out of sight, out of mind type of thing.
I mean, that could entirely be.
Maybe if they put eyes on it, they'd be like, okay, maybe not this guy.
But yeah. I mean, also, I think that we are talking about a period in time, like with the Crusades, for example, where that kind of like crazy, obscene violence is probably more popularized than we would think, you know? The death of a religious enemy, for example, I think is in many cases and many of these cultures, you know, something to be celebrated as opposed to, you know, something to be like lamented or something like
it's
that.
It's hard to put yourself.
Well, there's a lot of glorification of violence, I think, in the 15th and 16th centuries.
And we think about these communities being like isolated and stuff, but they had news. They had ways of news getting spread, and they had word getting spread from, you know, they knew Constantinople was the head of, so like Rome was still the head of the Catholic Church in Italy, but Constantinople, which was located in the Middle East, was more the head of the Eastern Orthodox religion, which is another version of Christianity.
Right.
And that was surrounded by these Muslim communities, these Muslim tribes, and we have been trying to take back
right.
The Europeans have been trying to take back the Holy Land and the Middle East for Christianity for centuries.
Yeah.
And they hadn't done it. And now you have Constantinople, which was not, it's not Rome. It's not the Catholic representation of Christianity, but it's the Christian representation of Christianity. Yeah, I think I just stumbled over that, but no. Our producer's frowning. I'm assuming he's frowning at me. Oh, he's looking at something else, but I'm just going to attribute it to me. But that wasn't
I think
it's like
you're right.
It was when, still being threatened.
Well, so I'm a pitch in here mm-hmm. with my knowledge of medieval literature, because as you know, I teach a lot of world literature, but I also mm-hmm. have a degree in Spanish literature and I've studied a lot of Spanish medieval yeah. literature, and there's a lot of accounts of kind of the glorification of this holy war, right? Mm-hmm. The Crusades being a vital and important part of identity making for a lot of Christians. Mm-hmm. And so we have a lot of literature that focuses very intently on the military efforts to retake the Holy Land. And I think that the propaganda machine of the church, kind of playing a large role in the development of a lot of this literature to garner popular support for these sorts of wars.
And I think somebody like, I agree 100%. And I think somebody like Dracula plays into that propaganda machine.
Sure, absolutely.
You have such a colorful figure, such a violent figure.
Right.
And it's like, ooh, we can use this to our advantage. And you'll see throughout the course of the story that it worked. It absolutely worked.
Yeah.
One thing I want to point out is that we're going to have some persnickety listeners out there who are going to say, actually, his name is Vlad Tepes. And I'm going to say to you, actually, I'm preemptively arguing with our listeners.
You pick a lot of preemptive fights on this show.
I really do. I'm going to say, actually, his last name wasn't Tepes. Tepes is Transylvanian or Moldovan or whatever the local dialect was of that time period for impaler. So when you say Vlad Tepes, you're just saying Vlad the Impaler.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of why we led off with all of us having our nicknames, because folks, there are going to be a ton of, as much bloodshed and gruesomeness there are in this story, there's also a lot of nicknames in this story. But the nicknames don't really overlap, so I think that'll help us keep track of some of these different characters.
Right.
Yeah. So before I go any further, though, I do want to reference our source, Dracula, Essays on the Life and Times of Vlad the Impaler. It is a English translation of a collection of essays and books and other writings from the Center of Romanian Studies. So this is as authentic as you can get, I feel like. And I brought a copy of the book here with me, so I'm holding it up in the studio, and everyone's like oohing and aahing and staring at it. And
yeah.
There's they're a just picture of, silent oohs and aahs.
They're silent oohs and aahs. And,
yeah. And a little painting of Vlad Tepes.
Little painting of Vlad the Impaler in front.
Yeah, that portrait is a little unsettling.
He's got a really good mustache.
He's got a good mustache.
If you're going to model one of your vampires on like an actual historical figure, this is the dude to do it.
That's
for
some
sure.
flowing locks too.
Yeah, he's got those nice cheekbones and all that.
And that sharp nose. It's a hawkish nose.
He kind of looks like Dustin Hoffman when he played Captain Hook.
Yeah, he totally does. Yeah. Totally right. Yeah.
Yeah, he kind of does look like Captain Hook a little bit.
I was just watching.
Here's the weird thing. I was just watching part of Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula last night, and Gary Oldman does a good job kind of looking like the part.
Yeah, a little bit.
So the other thing that I want to reference is this other name he's known by, which is Dracula. So I'm being adjusted. Okay. Ooh, that felt good. Okay. So the last name, Dracula. So there's a little bit of confusion on this as well, too. The second A in Dracula, so Dracula, the A means son of. So it literally means son of Dracul. So there are two interpretations.
But isn't Dracul like... I thought that was a name for dragon or something.
It's dragon, right?
Right. Yeah. It's dragon. Some people think it's the name. It also means the devil, which would contribute the cruelty of Vlad the Two and Vlad the Three.
That makes sense.
So the historical figure that we're focused on is Vlad the Third. But his father was Vlad Dracul, Vlad II. And it was they think more it was dragon because he was in probably a couple of years after Vlad II was, or Vlad III was born. Vlad II was named Prince of Wallachia, which is a region in Transylvania or a region in Romania, like mm-hmm. Wallachia and Transylvania and Moldavia. These are all really cool sounding like names that if you've watched Ghostbusters 2, like they're in there. But they all kind of take place in the realm of Romania at this time period. So he was named Prince of Romania or Prince of Wallachia, and he joined the Catholic Church's Order of the Dragon as kind of a protective warrior.
Dude, I want to join that order.
Order of the Dragon.
Yeah, not
that
even
cool, doesn't it?
Not even because I'm super into Catholicism. I just want to be like, I'm from the Order of the Dragon.
I'm from the Order of the Dragon.
You just want the membership card.
You know those guys in modern day carry like golden Berettas and just shoot people.
I was I'm glad you said modern, because I'm like, I don't think they have Berettas in 15th century Romania.
No, I'm talking about the evolution of the Order of the Dragon.
Oh yeah, I wonder if there is an actual Order of the Dragon still out there. Would you email us at editor@slayhouse.com? We would love to interview you for our podcast.
They're gonna show up with Matrix style sunglasses and kick in the door,
like bend around the bullets.
And if
shit.
there's not one, we'll just have to start it up ourselves.
Oh yeah, we're gonna start it. Really, you have to contact us, because if you don't, we're gonna start our own Order of the Dragon.
Yeah, and we will misrepresent you, and it's on you.
So we're not 100%. It's really funny to me is that we know certain specific dates because of papers and things that were written and transcribed in this time, but like other things we're not sure about, like the year of his actual birth, we don't know. We know Vlad II was already the Prince of Wallachia. We don't know when Vlad III, who is Dracula, we don't know when his birth was, but we think it's between like 1426 and about 1430. We know, And here's the thing. I'm going to apologize ahead of time for the pronunciation of some of these Romanian words. I did go to a website that showed me how to pronounce them, and so I tried to write the pronunciation correctly in parentheses, but if I butcher it, I'm sorry. So I'm doing the best I can with
it. A for effort, I think.
A for effort.
Go for it.
So they think Dracula was born in the town of Sighișoara. I think I said that right. Sighișoara.
Sighișoara.
He is the second of six kids. His father was Vlad Dracul II. He was the grandson of Mircea the Old. So, see, we're already getting into our nicknames.
There's
here.
There's the nickname. The Old.
I like that when he comes out of the womb, they look at him and they say,
he was a wrinkly baby.
That guy's the Old, right?
He's
there.
Mircea the Old.
Mircea the Old.
Just getting a feeling.
Ironically, he died when he was 35.
Well, that was old for back then.
I don't even know if that's a real, that was just a joke.
I know. Yeah,
we
I
probably
don't
have some Mircea fans out there who are like, you son of a bitch.
Mircea was not 35. He was 38. You bastard. Some Mircea fans.
We apologize to all you.
They got his posters up on the walls and stuff. Mircea.
We apologize to all you 15th century Mircea fans.
Yeah, Mircea rules.
Grandfather of Vlad III.
They've got their Google alerts out for Mircea.
But let's be clear. It's the grandfather that we're talking about here, and not Vlad's older brother, Mircea. Or
okay. What was his nickname?
I think I call it later. I think he's...
Handsome?
No, that's Radu. That's Vlad's little brother, Radu the Handsome.
I want that one.
Mircea the brother.
He had a little sister named Alexandra. That's way too easy. There was also Vlad the IV and the baby brother, Mircea. So he had an older brother named Mircea and a baby brother named Mircea.
Man, they really only liked like four names.
They really did, which is why they used nicknames, I think.
Yeah.
Because
that makes sense. When you know
Vlad's
like 12
brother,
Mircea's.
So Vlad, our Vlad, which Mircea? Our Vlad is Vlad the Impaler, but his little brother was Vlad the Monk.
Oh, wow. No, yeah.
Slightly different.
You kind of need it.
Yeah. Well, I'm a monk. When
not
I'm
to
impaler.
Be confused with, you know, like Vlad the lactose intolerant.
I think that was Vlad too. I think that was their dad. Yeah. Poor guy.
Vlad the Insufferable.
Yeah.
Vlad the Insufferable.
That's why they called him the Dragon. He just had terrible acid reflux.
So as a kid, Vlad gets a traditional European like royal education. So he's a very, probably a very, for that time, a very educated individual. Vlad III and his brother, Radu the Handsome, are intermittent hostages of the Turks until his father and older brother, Mircea, are killed. The father was beheaded, but the older brother was buried alive.
That's hardcore.
It's like terrifying to me. That's one of my fears, I think, is being buried alive.
Yeah, that's pretty awful.
I think it's a pretty primal fear.
Compared to some of the other deaths, though, that we're going to cover, I'm willing to bet that's not the worst.
That's probably pretty tame. Yeah, that's pretty tame. So Vlad, initially his cousin, Vladislav II, is away at battle with the Turks and with the Ottomans, and Vlad briefly obtains the throne. This is around 1448. And
so he would have been like maybe 20 years old?
Maybe 20 years old at the time when he first takes the throne. Yeah. Vladislav learns about this. He comes back. Vlad escapes to Moldavia.
Sure.
And befriended his new friend, Stephen the Great. Now, there's a nickname.
Yeah, Stephen the Great. I like that.
I want to be, can I be Jeremy the Great? Or Stephen am I just the Jeremy Great. The okay?
I would say I would call you Jeremy the Tolerable.
Well, yeah, okay, so that's why we went with that.
Were any of these people picking their nicknames, or were they given to them?
That's a really great question.
Why wouldn't everybody just call themselves like
Stephen the Great? Maybe it's like Hogwarts, where they had a magic hat, and it's like, Stephen the Great.
Right, yeah.
You are Vlad the... Okay.
The nickname chooses you.
The nickname chooses you. Yeah.
No, he has to differentiate himself from the other Stephen, who was like, maybe he wasn't Stephen the Great, but he was Stephen the
just fine
stand up dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stephen the not bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stephen the who will help you move.
Yeah. Stephen the just for a pizza.
Yeah.
Throughout history, you can always count on a Stephen.
Yeah. And then Radu the handsome also was paired up with Radu, the guy who always pitches in for pizza.
I like the idea that there's a Radu the handsome, and then there's like a Radu the homely.
Are you Radu the handsome? No, he's Radu the homely.
might be some hard feelings there.
Radu the jealous. Radu the homely, also known as Radu the jealous.
Just depends on how they're feeling.
I am
that
Vladislav the couch surfer.
The nicknames are like a mood ring.
So he meets Stephen the Great. Damn, I almost lost my place there. He meets Stephen the Great, who is the son of Bogdan the Second, and these guys are all protected by John Hunyadi. I think that's how you'd say his name. When Bogdan is killed, Stephen and Vlad transfer to Transylvania, or flee to Transylvania under Hunyadi's protection. So, in Transylvania, they continue their military training under John Hunyadi, and they meet Hunyadi's son, Matthias. And John Hunyadi, see, when Vladislav was away earlier, when Vlad temporarily took over the throne, he was in battle and he was allied with John Hunyadi. John Hunyadi is this powerful figure in Romanian history at this time. And so sometime after that, I guess when John Hunyadi started protecting Vlad and started like training the kids and stuff in Transylvania and all this, he had a falling out with Vladislav. And he was powerful enough that he could strip Vladislav of his throne, of all of his possessions, and basically just kick him out. So what's really interesting in this time period is we're going to see a lot of changing allies, not just within the boundaries of Romania itself, but also in relation to the Turks. So Vladislav, when he realizes he is no longer allied with John and he is a Romanian, he's like, well, I was fighting against the Turks. Now I'm going to fight with the Turks and fight against Vlad and fight against John Hunyadi.
Interesting.
And the Romanians. So there was a lot of shifting allegiances in this.
Makes a lot of sense too, though. I mean, feudal power, when we're talking, I feel like we haven't given enough, like,
we're assuming probably
focus
on the
feudal power, right?
Yeah.
But in the case that you don't know, your power is mostly derived by what kind of an army can you raise from the lands that you govern, right? So, if a dude comes in and says, hey, you know what, I'm taking your land and you don't have the men to defend it, or you don't feel as though your men are loyal enough to you to defend it, then, you know, you go and you find somebody else who can, you know, give you those dudes and then promise those dudes a parcel of land and say, you know, come fight for me at the end of this campaign. If you make it through and we win, hey, I'm gonna give you a farm. You know, you'll have your own place, your own area, your region, and a couple of peasants to look after it.
So it's all about who could promise the biggest amount of acreage, I guess, is kind of,
I don't even know it that it's necessarily about acreage so much as like, well, maybe sometimes because, yeah, you know, if your money is
or wealth
is,
or whatever.
Yeah. If your money is from land tenancy, or if your money comes from excess crops that you sell, you know, mm-hmm, then of course that's usually what you're looking for.
So, when he takes away, when John Hunyadi takes away Vladislav's possessions and his rule, he lets Vlad become the temporary kind of ruler of Wallachia, but he sends him to Moldavia to kind of face the Turks in this kind of area. So I'm using a lot of terms here, and the bad thing about a podcast, like a radio podcast, is like we don't have the visualizations to go along. Like we could use a map to kind of really kind of show where all this is taking place, but I think, you know, I mean, just realize that Romania kind of sits on the eastern edge of Europe facing like the Turkish and like, mm-hmm, the like Turkey and the Ottoman, you know, kind of the expansion and stuff. So the Turks and the Muslims in the Middle East finally destroy Constantinople, finally take it over. They kill Constantine the 12th, who is kind of the, he wasn't the Pope, but he was the head of the Eastern Orthodox.
Right.
Or maybe he was the Pope. Was he the Pope in that time?
But he was looking the 12th?
Yeah, he was probably, in Constantinople.
I don't know that. No, because the Pope is always in Rome. Or typically seated in Rome.
I think so. But this was a big religious figure.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what the title of that dude would have been for the Eastern Orthodox Church. It would have been, it would not have been the,
well,
I don't, I don't think
now,
there were rival popes
at
that
point. So.
Yeah. Well, but I mean, he would, I don't know if he would be like an archbishop or, you know, I'm not sure what the,
or he was whatever
the title
head of, maybe
the highest
Eastern Orthodox Church was at that time.
Right.
Yeah. So, but basically that church is falling, and this leaves Hunyadi as the last major obstacle to Ottoman expansion. So John Hunyadi spends a huge campaign fighting the Turks in Serbia. So there's, around this time, Vladislav, and we're probably mid-1450s at this point, Vladislav is killed. Either, they have two theories. He was either killed by Vlad himself, or he was killed by the boyars. And I mentioned that term earlier. Don't get too hung up on it, because boyars are just kind of the ruling class underneath the princes. Oh. So in like British terminology, that'd be like counts and dukes and stuff like that.
The Eastern, right. By the way, okay. The Eastern Orthodox Church was led by an emperor. Duh.
Okay. So his emperor,
the Holy Roman Emperor.
That's who it was. Yeah. Emperor Constantine.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Emperor Constantine the 12th.
Totally
yeah.
correct now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for fact checking us before our listeners would like email us or send us angry emails.
Yeah, they would have been, dude.
Like the Stephen Jones thing all over again.
No, we actually haven't read some of the fan mail that has come in. We're kind of saving some of it, I think.
Yeah.
For season two. When we return.
Yeah.
From hiatus, but man, we've got quite a few angry letters.
We have. We're doing.
We're doing our
best.
We're doing our best.
Yeah, it's an occupational hazard.
So, there's two theories on who killed Vladislav. I kind of want to lean towards Vlad killing him. You know, it wasn't just the boyars. I think Vlad starts his.
It's way more cinematic.
He seemed to like to have a hand directly in those types of matters.
Oh man!
Sometimes more than just a hand.
Yeah. Oh my god. He rolls his sleeves up. Let me get in there.
That's not how you do it. This is.
And then he grosses everybody out, and they all go, "Oh fuck."
So, around this time, also, not only is Vladislav killed, but John Hunyadi dies of a plague. So I had mentioned the plague early on. The plague is still rampaging through Europe and through hell, through everywhere, I think. Asia, Europe. I mean,
it does not go away.
It doesn't go away. And that was something I learned from like a podcast I listened to, is that we picture this period of the plague being like 10 years, but it actually in some form or other,
time.
Like,
it went on
for a couple hundred years.
I was going to say, if it's not more than one century, it was certainly a century of plague.
Yeah. Yeah. And it would like come in waves. So like come in, like wipe out whole towns and then leave and then come back.
And that was kind of the thing, right? You can't treat, they don't have vaccines to treat that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, for the most part,
they had no idea what to do about it.
Yeah. Well, you have such crazy rural communities, you know, a plague can wipe out a whole town and then, you know, you don't necessarily know about it until you walk in and suddenly are exposed to it. Carry it back to your community.
I was listening to a story.
And so it's going to spread very slowly, but devastatingly through a lot of these regions.
Well, and I was listening to a story that said, like, the British knew, like, they knew when the plague was coming up through, like, France and stuff, and they were like, yeah, we got to close our borders, and they're like, oh, and some were like, oh, it's never going to reach here, it's never going to cross the way, and sure fucking enough, it crossed the channel.
Well, I think it also happened, I mean, there are a lot of, like, ships, you know,
that
imports
trade
and exports,
and imports, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, so you bring a ship on without necessarily knowing that ship has, you know, the plague. I think eventually they got smart enough to know, like, nah, man, if you see that somebody's sick on that boat, you fucking burn it down before you let it in.
They
to
did.
Port.
They burned down a few.
Yeah.
Yeah. With live people on them.
Yeah.
And some of them even had, like, royalty, I think. They had,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
They're like royal, yeah, processions. You and they're just, like, we think you have the plague. You guys stay right there, get the matches.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. They just fire.
That's the height of pragmatism.
They fire arrows, yeah, or what? Or
well,
whatever.
And we made the joke cannon earlier, too, but they really thought this was, like, something from God. So it's like, let's all gather together and pray this thing away.
Yeah, through that filter, there's no telling how they responded to it.
Oh, yeah.
When you think it's God,
yeah.
Yeah.
You're going to go into...
Some guy got sick, so they just cut him open, bleed him out.
So he died.
Wow.
So at the time of John...
Died of the plague.
Yeah, John Hunyadi dies of the plague. And we won't get into how gruesome the plague itself was, but that was a gruesome enough death. But his brother, John Hunyadi's brother-in-law, is successful in stopping Mehmed II. Mehmed is the Ottoman Turk, or the Ottoman Sultan, who's trying to push forth into Europe. So he is successful in stopping Mehmed II's invasion. And Vlad, as a prince of Wallachia, looks to a neighboring principality, the Brasov, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, but he promises to protect them, and he has this show of strength. And all it told me in the research was that he killed many of their boyars as, like, a I will protect the rest of you, here's how strong I am. And he kills a lot of ruling class.
I like to think it's like a red wedding sort of thing.
Probably,
you know, he just gathers them all around,
just
and then,
a big
and
event
then just has them slaughtered,
make an example,
to make a political statement.
Yeah, yeah.
So in these next couple of years, he's challenged by many pretenders to the throne. Prince Dan.
I like that name. Prince Dan.
Prince Dan.
Yeah.
I just pictured like
here
a really,
goes Prince Dan.
I just pictured a really casual prince.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh, the kind of guy who tokes up before he, you know, like, yeah, goes to royal ceremonies and stuff. Yeah. Prince Dan.
I was down in the Mediterranean the other day. Met some hot Greek chick around, you know, yeah, islands. Yeah, what up?
It's Prince Dan. Prince Dan coming over in his flip flops.
With a Michelob Ultra.
Somehow
he had one.
Keep the calories down, brah.
Yeah.
You also have Vlad the Monk.
Yeah, yeah.
Vlad the Monk and Prince Basarab, mm-hmm, which is a cool name. Meanwhile, Stephen the Great, due to his victories in battle, was anointed Prince of Moldavia. And he was going to prove to be one of Vlad the Impaler's biggest allies throughout all of this. But I still can't get over the fact that his name is Stephen the Great. I think that's
Do
that's
you feel
perfect.
Like Steve
he
the Great
did feel a little
and
underwhelmed.
Prince Dan hung out?
They did, but they were both overshadowed by Johnny the Awesome.
Johnny Bravo.
Stephen the Great was great, Johnny the Awesome was just
just a little bit.
Just a little better.
Something about him, right?
Yeah. So.
Lord.
Meanwhile, Matthias, John Hunyadi's son that they had met while in doing their military training, mm-hmm, was made King of Hungary.
And that was in... We haven't really given a whole lot of dates.
We
for
haven't,
this,
but all this is like
but this
mid
is really
to late
like
1450s.
Yeah, through the 1450s, right? Yeah.
I didn't want to bog people down with a bunch of dates. This isn't a history class. I mean, it's a history story.
But you put all the dates on the script.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. Well, that's to help me keep track so I don't lose my place as much as...
It's not making a whole lot of really big jumps. It's just kind of...
No,
like,
it's like it's every year or so there's like a bit of an event. I think the idea here is that this all of this comes within the span of about a decade. So you can see Like these have, that's the thing. There's that's a there's a quick course. Succession of events, right? One thing leading to another as these dudes are like, you know, thrust out of their countries and they gather an army and they come back and they kill a whole bunch of nerds and then they, you know, set themselves up as these rulers. I think that what's really interesting is that like they're constantly moving, right? They're constantly making
these moves. To get into the part of the story where the dates get even more specific than just years. It's like down to the days,
right?
And like times of year.
Because now stuff is really kind of changing.
Like, for example, Vlad sends some emissaries to Brazov in Romania to improve relations with him. The thing about Brazov is that they had a lot of Saxons and they had a lot of Saxon merchants and they were competing with the merchants in Wallachia. So Vlad, I keep wanting to call him Brad.
Brad the Impaler.
Something
Brad.
Slightly less menacing about Brad you the know, Impaler.
My late grandfather was actually a Bradley.
Bradley.
Yeah, he was Brad.
Was he Brad the Impaler?
No. I don't think he ever impaled anybody.
Not that you know of.
He was just like Brad the Parkinson's guy. That's pretty sad. I don't mean to make light of it, but
okay. Oh, let's.
I did not have a very close relationship with Brad.
It sounds like okay. It. That's the worst nickname we've come across yet. Okay, so Vlad is trying to improve these relations because he feels like these Saxon merchants are coming over and just stealing everything from the Wallachian.
I'm sorry to my dead grandpa. So sorry.
Yeah. I mean, going by that logic, it should be John Hunyadi, the plague carrier.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Okay, so he decides to help protect his merchants. He's going to set up some specific times of year and some specific places where they can sell their goods so that it doesn't impact his merchants all that much. Those who disobey him are either beheaded or impaled. And there were 41 merchants on record and at least 300 youths who were helping out these merchants who were killed in such a manner. And that's where I want to pause in the script.
Who were killed, like they were impaled or burned alive?
Or burned alive, either one. Yeah, they were either impaled or burned alive.
I mean, so burning people alive was pretty common, I think.
Burning
in
people
this
alive
age.
Was common. Impalement is what I want to talk about really quickly. For our listeners, because we all have this image of impalement, but I'm going to get really graphic here, and this is kind of where the story gets kind of gruesome.
It's important.
It is important.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. He was called Vlad the Impaler. He didn't invent the idea of impaling people. He was just one who... He wasn't even the first person to do
it. He was just the merchant that brought it to...
He was just the best at it.
To the fore. Yeah.
So here's the thing about impalement. We picture these long, sharp spikes, like 20 feet tall, and, you know, people just... It's going through their torsos, and they're hanging from it.
Mortal Kombat style. Yeah.
Yeah, Mortal Kombat stuff. This is not... No. All right. So here's... There's a couple different ways you can impale people. One, you don't have a sharp end of the stick. You have instead a blunt edge, and you have the stick just long enough so that it's maybe a couple of inches taller once it's in the ground than the individual who's being impaled. So you grease up the end of the stick, and if it's a man, you grease up his anus, and if it's a woman, you grease up her vagina, and you shove this blunt end of the stick into that orifice.
Easy.
My whole body hurts right now with enough lubricant, why not?
My nervous system is
this is
like
the sort of thing that my wife is really into in books, by the way.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I don't know that's true. I don't know that it's crazy.
50
the
Shades
stuff they're
of
into.
Awful.
Yeah.
Then they set the stake upright on the ground so that it's now inside the orifice, and the person is having to stand on their tiptoes. So as long as you can stand on your tiptoes, you're uncomfortable, but you're kind of okay. It's when your legs start to give out and the pole is forced up into you as you slide down, and it goes into your body cavity and then up through eventually comes up through your chest or through your neck or through your mouth. And it takes hours, if not hours, it takes days. There are records of some people taking 6 days to die. There were instances where the blunt even when they whittled down the blunt end of the stick that would go through the impaling, it was still too large. So if it was too large for whichever orifice we were using, then they had to take a knife and cut the orifice to make it fit.
Right.
Oof. Oofa doofa.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's how you handle that.
Yeah.
They would use sharp sticks. They would use even taller sticks. They would also go through the torso if they had to. They used horses to pry the person's leg apart, get the stick inside of them, and then set them upright so that they could...
The first time I ever heard of, like, someone being drawn and quartered, I was like, oh, fuck. That's pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
pretty gruesome.
This is worse than that, I would say.
I think of the... Yeah.
Imagine taking 6 days to die.
Well, I mean...
Like, right. with this stick going through your body, and you feel your body settling onto this...
In a lot of ways, this is the same kind of treatment as, like, a crucifixion. Is it a crucifixion... Yeah, okay, you get nailed to a cross or something like that.
It's got
to
be worse, right?
You hang up there on a cross for a long time before you die. I mean, that's several... We talk several days before you're finally dead. And most of the time, it would take so excruciatingly long to die on a cross, people would come out and break your legs because...
Or they would stab you with the spear.
That's how you would... Basically, you'd suffocate. Mm-hmm. The spear stabbing, I don't think was as like that was more kind of a test to make sure someone was dead.
Oh yeah.
Right. No, they would come out and they'd break your legs because you needed your legs in order to breathe, and so they would.
They're like, get this over with.
Yeah. So they go and they break your legs, and then you'd actually suffocate to death.
Lord,
it's pretty bad.
I mean, if you're going through any of these things and it's taking days, you're likely to die.
But these are,
sun exposure,
I mean, these are very
hunger,
highly public. I mean, these are not intended to be. You don't go and you impale someone just to kill them, right? You go and you
this
impale someone.
Yeah,
it's
a statement, and it's as much for your enemies who aren't being impaled as it's like, look at what I just did.
Was this something he did like in public, like as a spectacle?
Oh yeah, you put him out. Yeah,
this is public. Yo, wait, it gets even better.
Okay,
are you ready for
these
this?
These are the lawn decorations.
So you guys mentioned the Red Wedding. Well, he held on Easter of 1459, 1460. He held a banquet in the town of Targoviste. Which is the town where his brother was buried alive. And out of revenge, and this is years after his brother was killed, but he was still pissed about it. So out of revenge for them killing his brother, he had 50, and some say up to 500 boyars killed for being aligned with this Dan the Pretender guy.
Oh, this is Prince Dan.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no, this
Dan
is
the
Vlad
Pretender?
Doing it. Yeah.
No. I'm saying the Dan that he's making
a Prince
statement
Dan.
To is Prince Dan the Pretender.
Prince Dan the Pretender.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And these boyars who are aligning with Prince Dan, he's like, oh, you want to align with them? Fine. And he had them killed. Then he took Targovistan elders and had them impaled and sent the youths to go work on his castle, Poyanari, which I think I mispronounced. But that, if anybody's seen like the famous Castle Dracula, like the ruins on top of the hill or on top of the mountaintop, that's the castle that he sent these youths to work in. I'm trying to say youths like...
That's the one you can go visit
youths,
like right
like
now.
My
right?
cousin Vinny, like the youths.
Yeah, I don't know what
yeah, was
with that
Yeah, you can go visit
accent.
It right now.
Yeah.
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 I don't think they still have the impaled elders out on the... I'm just saying.
Probably not.
That'd be cool.
I don't know.
What's the joke I put on Twitter? Like Vlad the Impaler winning Halloween decorations for 3 years in a row or something?
Lord.
So, So Dan, in response to this, Dan the Pretender, hey guys, it's okay, man. It's all right. He raises an army from Brasov and attacks Wallachia. Vlad, in response, orders Dan to dig his own grave. Then, before he kills him, he has the funeral rites read over him. So the guy just dug his own grave. He's like, okay, now we're going to read your funeral over you. And then he has him beheaded. So that's like a huge, like, fuck you to this
dude.
What a
bro. What a dude.
At least he got the fast way, though. He was just beheaded.
Yeah. I mean, they say your head still lives, like, after a few seconds.
Well,
after that. Like,
but
yo, I would
body.
Take that
but even
over
then,
any of this other stuff
I feel
about.
Like... Yeah. Like the, because it's just a display of humiliation, right?
Yeah.
He's like, I'm gonna have you're gonna see your funeral and then I'll kill you.
Digging your own. Yeah. The whole thing is to humiliate.
Yeah, you're gonna labor and then mm-hmm. and then I'll do it.
Yeah.
Oof, guys. Oof.
Oof, guys. Oof.
Yeah. So he forced their citizens to pay reparations for supporting Dan.
Yeah.
He's
extorting him.
Yeah. Here's a tax. Tax for being a douche to me.
Yeah.
You guys didn't come to my birthday party, so you got to make up for it.
And he burned down two neighboring villages or towns, I guess, or the two little districts.
Wow.
Because they supported Dan. So it's like, it was a big, these are huge displays of power.
I mean, can you imagine? Maybe it's because I have the most recent national election on the brain, but this is kind of like, oh, you voted for, Trump or you voted for Biden or whatever. I'm going to burn your house down.
This is what happened.
This is basically the same idea.
We ought to be careful about airing this podcast. It could give people ideas.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Change the subject.
So the Turkish Sultan Mehmed sends an envoy to order Vlad to pay 3 years back tribute and he wants Vlad to send him 500 youths that have been promised over the period of time. And he was using them for probably slave labor or probably sexual, I don't know what all of he's using them for.
I thought probably just so when I see something like you need to send me 500 youths, I think
what's a ute?
No, I think it's probably it could have been for labor, but it could also have been again when we talk about power in feudal lands, we're talking about what kind of an army can you raise, and so he may have actually been asking for soldiers, I want you to send me 500.
Yeah, 500 is a big number. You wouldn't want to squander that.
No,
you wouldn't want to just murder.
And
all of them.
And I feel like the reason for youths would not necessarily be for something like sexual enslavement or something.
Yeah, that's true.
I think he's really talking about I want young, able-bodied men who you can send to me because I'm going to add them to the ranks of my army.
Right.
I just assume youths meant men and women. So I figured maybe some women would probably.
See, I don't know that women were traded like that.
Maybe not.
Again, in a feudal company, in a feudal.
Are you saying it would have been futile?
Yeah. Resistance is futile. No, I think it was probably, I read 500 youths as 500 able-bodied men to young men to go and labor, labor and, useful, and join the army.
Useful youths, right? And, there's a young person can be convinced of a lot of things too.
Yeah.
So there's probably a lot of propagandizing.
That could entirely be.
Well, I think this is the story where it said that Vlad, in response, nailed the turbans to the emissaries' heads before sending them back to the Sultan as kind of a.
Jeez, Vlad, calm down.
Oh no. It gets better. So Mehmed hires a Greek named Karavolinos to meet Vlad at the town of, I'm going to butcher this,
Giurgiu.
And Karavolinos brought some Turks, and he was going to arrest Vlad, but Vlad shows up with the tribute, and he shows up with 50 children. But Vlad also secretly brings an army, and he surrounds Karavolinos and the Turks. And he takes Karavolinos and the head of the Turkish army, this guy named Hamza, and he impales them higher than the soldiers, but he also impales the soldiers, and he hangs all of them right outside the gates of Chagrivista for more than a year.
Your pronunciation of that town has changed. I think every time you say
Teravagista.
Now, if they were there for a year, you're talking about a site.
Teravagista.
So they die it takes 6 days to die. They're all flailing. And this is probably the image of him. It said he drank blood and dined underneath the bodies of the impaled.
Right.
This is probably that image of him dining under the bodies, and he lined the roads with their bodies, their impaled corpses and stuff.
Come, my dear. We're going to have, I know, a nice little hole in the wall around the corner.
Oh, the air.
I know a nice place.
The air smells so rancid.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God. Oh, the children are of the night. What noises they make.
Have you been to the new place between Bob and Steve over there?
Oh, my God.
It's a real hole in the wall.
Yeah. Exactly.
So after he impales these bodies, he begins a campaign against the Turk, or against the Turks. He numbers the heads of all of his victims so that he can report to the king that he kills 23,884 Turks. That is such a specific number.
Okay, so, yeah. And this is over the span of a year. This guy must have been just like metal. I mean, yeah. Granted, I don't think Vlad himself was not the dude who killed 23,884 Turks.
I mean, but he led the people.
But I kind of feel like, yeah.
He was not sitting behind the lines going, do this. He was out front, I feel like.
He was like involved.
Well,
I believe he probably did actually
kill some people.
Oh, yeah.
I don't necessarily know that he's going to lead the charge in an army. I don't know that any leader does that.
Oh, right.
I think there are stories of people who do that because the stories are impressive. I don't believe that Vlad himself was like leading any charges. I think he would have directed those charges. And I fully believe this dude did slaughter some people. I don't think he's on the front lines, though.
I think it's not a standard battle, though. I mean, like the Turkish army invading is a standard army, and this is kind of what we've seen throughout history. Vlad knew the army that he raised could not stand against them on a strict battlefield and fight them. So he had to employ, he employed scorched earth policy. He employed like guerrilla warfare tactics. And in guerrilla warfare, those leaders usually do lead from the front. They're like, I'm right here with you. We're going to hit this area like this. He might have a few other pockets of army soldiers that are like hitting over here and over here. But he is leading one of those pockets. It's not, you're right. It's not a standard like battlefield moment where two armies clash together.
Yeah.
It's more like, The Turkish have come to fight that kind of army, and he's like just systematically hitting them at different points. And I bet he is probably leading some of those charges himself. I mean,
so some of the smaller skirmishes, maybe.
Yeah.
He got to pick which one. He picked the low key.
No, I mean, you don't live very long as a dude who goes into just a bunch of fights on the front lines. I'm just saying.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. In the Battle of Turnu, he realized he could not match the Sultan's army. He's like, I can't fight them head on like that. So he had to employ those guerrilla warfare tactics. So on 16 June 1462, as the Turkish army were sleeping in their encampment, Vlad leads an assault on them, an overnight assault using torches and horns, probably to help distract them, but also to help his men kind of coordinate where they were at. I think they used cavalry. And they swooped in and they just slaughtered a bunch of the sleeping Turks. Yeah. And they did not incur themselves a huge amount of losses in their own forces. They slaughtered them, tore them to shreds. Now, we talked about how they're not leading from the front line, but Mehmed II was there. He was in the encampment.
Oh, I'm not saying that they don't, that Vlad was not present for a lot of these fights.
Yeah.
But yeah, usually you hang back. You charge into battle and some dude with an arrow has your number. Yeah. That could go real bad for you.
Imagine just being the very first one to drop.
Yeah.
The leader.
Yeah,
the
no,
leader
I think that would suck real bad.
And they all go,
let's get them, guys.
Yeah. Game over, I guess.
Well, shit.
We'll just go home.
That feels like a Monty Python skit.
Yeah, seriously.
So it was so bad, apparently, that the Sultan like ran off. Like he like retreated from the battle.
Oh, no.
And his own men had to go and get him and like bring him, like forcibly bring him back. So it's like Spaceballs kind of shit. Like Mehmed II's like, fuck this, I'm out of here. Oh. He like runs off and they're like, nope, and they drag him back.
They should have given him a nickname right then.
Yeah, Mehmed the Cowardly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mehmed the suddenly come to his senses.
Mehmed the bitch ass.
But after they slaughter him, they retreat back into the mountains, and the Turks are so terrified they don't even want to come like chase after him into the mountains. But they keep pressing forward anyway. So the army keeps moving forward while Vlad keeps these like guerrilla tactics up. They're starving. They're weakened. They finally arrive to Thervogista. I'm trying to pronounce that correctly.
You even wrote down the...
No, that's how it sounded like it was pronounced. I typed in the thing, Thervogista.
Thervogista.
But it sounded like...
Thervogista.
Thervogista. I played it several times to try and get this right. So that's the way it sounded to me. So maybe I'm wrong. Thervogista, I don't know. Anyway, the Turkish army arrives at this city. And they see these impaled bodies of the guys that Vlad had previously impaled, Keravalinos and Hamza, and those Turkish soldiers. And they're terror stricken. They're completely like just shocked and just
because they're, duh.
You wanna do what to my what? I'm running away.
Just like that.
Oh no.
Yeah. I tried this once with my wife. It did not work out.
Oh my god.
Runs away.
So
certainly not because of Vlad's dancing skills.
So they go and retreat, and there were some boyars that were helping them. Radu the Handsome was helping the Turks. Mehmed wanted to depose, isn't that right? Depose, I guess, depose.
Yeah.
Or dethrone Vlad from rule, and he wanted to install Radu the Handsome in his place because Makes he sense. Thought he would be a little more...
handsome.
He'd be more handsome. He was definitely more handsome.
Yeah, royalty becomes him.
But we were talking earlier about how this stuff spreads through Europe, and we talked about the propaganda, and that's exactly what we see here, because people heard about Vlad's victory over the Turks and over these Muslim invaders, and it spread across Europe, and people were cheering him on. And
impale more people.
Yeah, impale more people. Yeah, do whatever you want as long as it's not to
impaling
us.
Impaling is all the rage in Europe these days.
I was afraid one of us would go there. Vlad impaled me twice last night.
No,
fear is confirmed.
That was not my intention. Yeah. It was more like the fashion moguls.
Yeah,
oh,
okay.
Home deck. It's like
that's what I thought.
HGTV was like, you know, Vlad the Impaler is so hot right now.
Yeah.
Dungeon chic. Yeah.
We're redoing your home.
I'll take some.
These were the former peasants of this land.
I'll take some shiplap, and we'll want to decorate with this style with the little bit of the impaled corpse in the corner.
Yeah. This throw rug is going to go really well with the Afghani child that we just killed.
See how the blood on these tapestries match the crimson thread used? God.
Your enemies won't know what to think when they come traipsing up onto your property.
Medieval Europe was savage.
On the next Romanian house flip.
Oh, God.
We found the former tenants buried in the floorboards.
They make great decor for your... all right. So not only it's funny though, not only were they in retreat at this point, but then Vlad like taunts them as they're retreating. He like keeps attacking them and keeps like taunting them. So he's like adding that extra level of asshole.
Gotta flex.
I know you do. Yeah. So what happened is Radu decides he needs to face off with Brad
was another of my grandfather's nicknames.
Was it Rad Brad?
Rad Brad.
Brad the Rad?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Okay. Yeah, you're trying to like work some revisionist history in here.
Yeah, right? Into it. Yeah, my relationship with my grandpa.
So the Turks support Radu as he's fighting Vlad and trying to take the fight to Vlad himself. And the two of them have a lot of battles. But... even though Vlad, I feel like I'm jumping the gun here. No, I'm not. I'm right on target. Even though Vlad wins a lot more of those skirmishes with his brother, Radu, because of his kindness, so he's not just Radu the Handsome, he's Radu the Kind, wins over more supporters. I mean, Vlad, it sounds like all the stories we're hearing of him so far, he's just pissing everybody off.
He's kind of the Kylo Ren of medieval history here. Yeah. No, I stand by that. I think when you look at like this ruler, who are you going to hang out with? Are you going to hang out with Radu the Handsome? He is a good looking dude. Or are you going to hang out with Vlad the Impaler? And you're like, Vlad's into some weird shit here.
But if you're following the rule of keep your enemies closer, I think you go with Vlad, right?
If you think of Vlad as an enemy.
If you think he might impale you.
He called himself metal. I mean, he is kind of metal. He's doing all the shit he needs to do.
It's like the crux of metal.
Yeah.
Everything he did.
Super hardcore metal.
Yeah. I mean.
He's really into it.
Yeah. Black Sabbath did not invent metal. It was this guy.
Yeah. It was this guy.
Right?
Yeah. So the the Transylvanian king, the Romanian king, decides maybe having Vlad there, because Radu is winning over some supporters, maybe having Vlad there is not the best thing. So he forged some letters lying about Vlad's allegiance with Mehmed II. Kind of scandalous kind of ideas, saying, you know, he's really helping them and he's really going to turn on the rest of Europe. And he uses these letters to arrest Vlad and imprison him. And he imprisons him for like 13 years. And that's a huge chunk of the rest of Vlad's
Whoa.
Life. Yeah. He's held in various locations during his imprisonment. And over time, you know, just some more battles continue. I mean, like Stephen the Great, defeats the Turks and he defeats Radu the Handsome. He asks, he supports Basarab, the Prince Basarab, in taking the Wallachian throne. But Basarab himself, you know, I was talking about how allies shift. Basarab himself goes back to the Turkish Sultan and he asks for support. So there's a lot of back and forth. So when that happens, Stephen goes to Matthias, the king who had Vlad in prison. He says, look, we need a Christian. This guy's a Muslim. We need a Christian ruler for Wallachia. And we really need Dracula back. So it's at that point that Dracula is freed. But despite his
I like the idea that over 13 years, these guys are like really reminiscing about the times they had with Dracula.
Yeah, we need to like,
oh man, remember back in the day with Dracula?
Everything was
that guy was hardcore, but there was nothing finer than a sunny morning out on the impalement field.
Yeah, the forest, right? Did they call it the impalement forest?
Impalement forest, yeah, something like that. Yeah, I just pictured Dracula like sitting in his cell, like getting like buff, like doing like pull-ups and stuff.
I'm gonna impale so many people.
And, like,
when
for
I get
13
out of here.
Years, he's like doing push-ups and pull-ups and like really getting stout. And then they come to him, Dracula, we need you, and he goes, time to get back to work.
Yeah. No, even better. At first, he's like, I don't do that anymore.
You've got the wrong guy for this.
Yeah.
No, Dracula.
Surely, Dracula, you remember how to impale people. You never forget. It's like riding a bicycle.
All right, let's go to work.
But easier. Yeah.
Easier than riding a bike.
Oh,
like
man.
Riding a bike without a seat.
Oh, my God.
Well, instead of sending him back to Wallachia to fight the Turks, Matthias sends him to Serbia. And again, when Dracula gets there, he just kicks ass all over. He just kicks ass and takes names. He's like, I came to Serbia for two things, blood and impalement, and I'm almost out of blood. But it's because of his victories in Serbia that he's seen again as the Prince of Wallachia. So in November of 1476, he and an army supported by Stephen the Great succeed in defeating and dethroning Basarab, even though 10,000 men are lost in that battle.
Ooh,
that is a tough
fight. We throw around some of these numbers, like 5,000 or 500 people were killed or 10,000 people die in this battle or whatever. And it's like, that's a lot of
people. You got to consider 10,000 people. How big are your armies, right? Because you're raising these people out of your own lands. Mm-hmm. These are leaders who are supposed to, you know, come to your aid. Yeah. 10,000 people, that's a lot. A substantial loss if you're looking to also turn around and manage these lands, right?
Well, on 16 November, Dracula arrived in Bucharest and received the oath of allegiance from the boyars, but he would learn that that allegiance would not last very long. On the 26th of November, the Great Assembly of Transylvania recognized Vlad as the Prince of Wallachia. So all this time, and he's finally getting that recognition that he needs, that professional recognition. Stephen the Great gives him 200 Moldavian soldiers to guard him, but early January 1477, Basarab returns with the disloyal boyars, and they attack Vlad, and they kill him.
Mm.
But not before he takes his own sword and kills five of them himself.
Five dudes
before they take him down.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's a real Boromir kind of moment.
If you try to mentally play that out, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
To imagine him, like, surrounded.
Yeah, that's why when you were saying, like, you didn't think he would lead a lot of that, skirmishes, I'm like, I don't know, man. This dude is fucking...
No, like I'm not saying he's a bad fighter. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, he's very crafty, very meticulous in his planning. But I think in that part of that show of strength is he would have to do some of it. He would have to kill.
I don't doubt that he went out and killed some people.
At least for his own troops, his own soldiers, to be like, I'm not just telling you to do this. Watch me do it.
Yeah.
I mean,
how are you, if you're Vlad the Impaler, how are you going to hold on to a whole bunch of people who are going to follow you around?
Yeah.
You're going to impale some motherfuckers, you know? Yeah.
That's what you do.
I don't think they know exactly where his tomb is, but they suspect it's being in the church in the Snagov monastery. I don't know what I was just saying.
Montessori school.
You can visit Vlad.
This is Vlad the Impaler.
Bring
your children to this school.
So they think it's in the church. In the church, is that still standing? By the way,
I think it is.
That church.
I didn't look it up, but I think it is. I think that's probably a tourist attraction. Like we have.
I
think they said he was beheaded, though. I think I forgot to write that down. I think he was beheaded because I think his head was taken to the Sultan, or at least there's a legend that his head was taken to the Sultan to show, like, look, we finally killed this fucker.
Yeah,
24,000 men later.
Yeah.
But you know what? I mean, even like you guys talked about this, and even to this day, the Romanians still see him as a political hero. Like, and I'm sure the vampire story reached their ears in some form or another. But from what I was reading, like the research I showed, Dracula, the novel, wasn't translated into Romanian until around 1990. So I'm not saying they probably weren't aware of the vampire story, but it wasn't translated so that it was mass marketed for the country until like the 1990s.
So his awfulness wasn't what was on their
minds. They saw him as a political hero. He kept the enemy at bay. He stopped them.
So when they read Stoker's Dracula in 1990, I wonder what they thought.
Weren't like an isolated community. So I imagine some of them went out into Europe or came to the United States. They probably saw some of the movies. They probably, learned of the story. Yeah. Like if they were bilingual and they studied English, they probably learned the story. I mean, that's probably, I think that what this is saying is like the country as a whole was not exposed to that kind of pop culture reference until very, very late in the game,
right,
is what I'm thinking. So it didn't color their perception of Dracula.
Right.
He was still like, now that's not to say if you go to Romania today, they're not going to have like little vampire things like hanging around and stuff. I think they do, but they're playing on the myth. I mean, that's a cash grab.
It's like Roswell, New Mexico with the aliens.
Yeah, exactly.
I think maybe to perceive this in a way, right? Like Dracula is a villain. Dracula is the bad guy in Bram Stoker's novel.
Yeah.
Whereas this particular figure, right, Vlad Dracula, would be the political hero. Yeah. So I think some of this, like the perception of Vlad Dracula in Romania that we're talking about, not being influenced by Dracula himself, like the fictional Dracula, is probably like in terms of the reverence they have for this figure.
So you think they kind of have like separate lives?
Yeah, I think, instead of thinking of him as this terrible dude, I think they look at him as like, again, kind of a political hero fighting against the what would you call them? The terrifying forces or these existential forces from a foreign land that's, trying to invade Europe.
But here's the flip side of that. Dracula, the fictional character, if Bram Stoker did this research and learned even half these stories about this guy, I mean, like I said, these stories existed in Vlad's lifetime, so it wouldn't have been hard for him to learn about these ideas and this character, mm-hmm. this historical figure. The historical figure did color the perception of the fictional character.
I think that, again, like when we talk about a lot of this, the perception of Vlad Dracula is probably much more oriented less toward, like the impaling stuff, which is definitely hardcore, but it's who he's impaling, which would be the Turkish people, and the Turkish people were a much greater existential threat through the Middle Ages than, we really give credit for. One of the most famous authors, I think, from, like the 16th century, certainly, would be Miguel de Cervantes. Mm-hmm. Cervantes, one of the most celebrated literary figures of all time, participated in a lot of like warfare against Muslim forces in Europe, right? So, and certainly against the Turkish forces in as they continue to try to make their way into Europe. So when you have this kind of existential enemy for centuries of warfare, and you have a guy who stands up to those enemies, he can kind of become a symbolic figurehead for the fight, you know, against these forces that are invading your space.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that for these people, glorifying him as a political presence probably makes a whole lot of sense, because, you know, he's the hero that helped you maintain your autonomy against a force that is at extreme opposites to your worldview.
Right.
Right.
And what's weird is, like, for me, I didn't know that Dracula was based on a real person until I was probably a teenager when I found that out, and I went, what? So for, you know, for some people, Vlad existed as a person and they didn't know about the vampire stuff. And then for a lot of other people, he only exists as a vampire and you didn't know he was a real person.
And I think in this sense, you know, again, like, you know, you look at the Dracula as a real person and for what he stood for, you're probably a big fan. If you're a Romanian and you have this kind of racial hatred against the Turks,
right?
You know, you probably are really
racial
into Dracula.
And religious hatred.
Really, yes, yeah.
And exactly. if you don't have any of the historical context, you're just hearing this guy was impaling people, and you're just like, well, that's bad.
That's really metal.
Like, those were people that he impaled. Right. Some people are like, no, it's the specific people.
Yeah.
that makes it okay.
And the fictional Dracula, as a villain, you know, may not vibe with the view that you have of, like, the actual literal human being who, you know, lived through history.
Yeah,
I think that seeing those two very differently. And then if we're talking about the 90s, as we maybe expand some of our cultural understanding and realizing that maybe the Turks weren't necessarily the villains of history that our propaganda has told us, you know, maybe our view of the enshrinement of Vlad Dracula as champion of Christian forces or Christianity, maybe that starts to soften a little bit. I don't know.
Well, that's what I want to talk about, like, with next episode, is that we get into, you know, of course, the novel itself at this point, because now I think we're really informed to really talk about the novel.
Yeah.
And we talk about all the adaptions, but you make a good point. Like, in the 90s, they start in the 90s, in early 2000s, they really start blending this idea of the historical figure and the supernatural figure together. And we start seeing that as kind of a new way to both humanize and also add a little bit of terrifying reality to the story itself.
It's all so rich with, like, literary potential, right?
It really is.
Oh, sure.
And that, all of this goes back to my original thesis that this is, you know, this is why this story works on so many levels. And that, I feel like, I don't know, that's a qualifier of literature, at least as its influence and its lasting power, is on how many different levels it's able to work. And if you're able to make a complex story that people really enjoy, then you're going to achieve that kind of literary worth. I feel like, I don't know. What do you think, Trevor? It's that.
I mean, I think there is an argument to be said or to be had there, right? The thinking about what makes the lasting power of this particular story. Cause as we think about Dracula, you know, what is it that fascinates us about Dracula? What fascinates us about Vlad Dracula? You know, I think for me, what is interesting about this figure isn't just how hardcore metal he is, right? But I think it's also interesting that he's a political figure, a political leader, playing a very vicious game, right? Of feudal politics at a time in history that is very volatile, right? And so the measures he takes is being very, very extreme. And I don't think I would categorize them in any other way than extreme.
Right.
I think we're a political tactic for this guy to try to codify and maintain his power, his political power. And whether or not that's very successful, I mean, his reign was pretty short lived in a lot of ways. You know, being imprisoned for 13 years before he comes back for his last hurrah.
Doesn't sound like it all worked out the way he...
Right, exactly.
It didn't insulate him the way he thought it would.
So I think historically we look back and kind of romanticize some of the... And one of the reasons why I push back against this guy, you know, the idea of this guy like out on the front lines and like slaughtering people. I don't know that... I think that's a romanticized view of history. I think that's a romanticized view of this guy because we want the story of the powerful ruler who is just like so unmatched in his military and like his combat martial prowess, right? That that we enshrine him. And I think that what I want to do is really reframe him in a real actual political moment and understand that the things that he did, you know, the stories that we tell of this guy really should be framed in the context of these were politically motivated actions, right? He was fighting a holy war that he felt was important to his goals. But even aside from fighting this holy war, he was also trying to maintain and protect his power against the other power hungry nobility, you know, the other power hungry individuals from his land that were constantly looking to take his seat from him.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Yeah.
It's a very King of the Hill kind of.
Oh, and that's so
like
much
the childhood game, not the TV show.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that that's so much of what we see in history, you know. As we talk about this stuff, I'm constantly leaning back on my knowledge of 15th century Spain and some of the stuff that they went through and talked about. You know, we think of stuff like the Spanish Inquisition as being this like horrible time in history. It was that was a political tool in order to enshrine the power of the Catholic Church in Spain, you know. And I think that what we see here as the extremes, you know, because the Spanish Inquisition was very extreme. They executed a lot of people. And if they didn't execute them, they burned them in effigy. Right. Basically, they chased them out of the country and then symbolically murdered them. And said, you know, like they're never coming back. And I see the same extremes mirrored in like the actions of someone like Vlad Tepes, who was maybe 40 years before the Spanish Inquisition really kicked it. But it's the same kind of political statement. It's the same, like I'm codifying my power through violence, because that's the most effective way I think I can secure my legacy.
What fascinates me is when I put this into perspective and I'm like, okay, we are 600 years now from these events talking about a guy who basically ruled for like 4 years and a few months.
Yeah.
And it's like, that would be like 600 years from now, like in 2622, people sitting around talking about, well, you remember, you know, Gerald Ford.
It's like, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
and it's like, I mean, that to me is just mind blowing that we have somebody with such a short kind of. I say Gerald Ford. I didn't go for the obvious.
You know,
like
I also
Trump
think it's really interesting
or
that
Bush Senior or whatever.
I also think it's really interesting because I think, to me, if we wanted to reframe this in like modern American terms, I feel like this is the same kind of enshrinement of like the legacy of the Confederacy. Yeah. Right. Like I see, because the Confederacy was only a couple years.
It was about 4 years.
Yeah. And, but you have these people who are still like intensely loyal to what the Confederacy, stood for. Right. And I think that even today in Europe, you know, the stories that we tell of Vlad Tepes or whatnot, I think they've had standing power because the prejudices against, for example, people from the Middle East and certainly Turkish people have not changed. You know, I was in a very committed relationship with a German woman for a bit of time, and she had an intense racial prejudice against Turkish people. To the point that I think that still sticks around. You know,
she was
I think
also
that these,
the one who carried Trevor around everywhere they went.
Yeah.
Come with me, little Trevor. I'll hoist you up.
I put you in my pocket.
She's a very interesting woman. But I think that...
We just lost the German market.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
I lost the German market a long time ago.
Alvita Zane.
No, but I think that again, you know, we look at the fascination with a figure like this, and I don't know that I can divorce the fascination with this figure from a lot of the, you know, racial prejudice that I think still exists against the people that Vlad Tepes is famed for fighting.
There's still so much to go over and so many right. stories and perspectives and context yeah. to cover.
It's,
right?
it's really dense, and trying to unpack it is really
so
quite
Dracula,
fascinating.
Dracula may not be something that ever stops getting written about, right?
Right. I think not.
Yeah,
I think
in a way, yeah.
That, yeah.
And I think that as we'll cover a little bit when we get into our next episode, right? Like, Dracula as a literary figure is really interesting for how he acts and interacts with us symbolically, because he represents so many different forces. He represents, of course, some of the Victorian fears that Stoker had or was kind of working with because of his political moment, but he's also representative of this interesting kind of supernatural, mythological violence. I think the symbolic violence of Dracula through, you know, leaning on this historical Vlad Tepes is also very interesting. And to your point about literature and you know, what makes for a really interesting or good story, you know, I think that there is some exchange that we get from you know, kind of symbolizing this history a little bit. It adds an extra dimension to the figure that maybe perhaps either literally or subconsciously plays on our expectations.
I think too, like speaking from a writer's perspective, I'm not saying like Bram Stoker visualized all of this as he begun the story, but I think what it shows us, like especially from his notes, which we still have in writing this novel, is that it came in waves and in pieces. So he knew the story he was telling up front, but he knew how he wanted to tell it, but he kept adapting the story as he got new pieces of information. And he was probably, in fact, I'm going to almost guarantee he was aware enough as a writer to say, hey, I see the level of complexity and what this will do to the themes I'm exploring if I include this historical figure in this new way. Like if I make him the villain, I see exactly what that's going to do. I see how this is going to impact the story and broaden the views of the story that I'm trying to tell. He spent more time, and I said this during the biography episode, he spent more time writing Dracula than he did any of his other novels. Like he was pumping out like a novel a year, maybe sometimes even two novels in one particular year, all while he was still researching, putting together Dracula. So it was almost like, and one of his biographers said, it's almost like he knew the importance of Dracula even before it was published. And so I don't feel like we talk about these things and it's like, can we really give him credit for all of these ideas? And I think, yeah, we can. We absolutely can. Because as a writer, even if you're not writing this stuff down, like when you set out to write a novel or a short story or something, even if you're not writing this stuff down, you're still thinking about it in some way in your head. Mm-hmm. It's still going on. Like, how is this impacting the story that I'm trying to tell? And I'm positive that he was visualizing all of this and seeing the complexity of all of this, even as he's acquiring and folding in new information.
Yeah. I'm not sure that my reading of Dracula, the novel, and again, you know, not to take the thunder away from that conversation, I don't know how much the history of this figure is reflected directly in how I read the novel and how I interpreted the novel. I don't know that the symbolic resonance with this particular history is as clear to me, but I do think that it'll be interesting to hear your thoughts in the next episode.
So one of the things that I will, and I want to preview with that, is as I've been reading through and learning about this other book that I'm going to talk about in the fourth episode too, is this Powers of Darkness and how different it is from the version of Dracula. And there's an argument that Powers of Darkness was translated off an older version of Dracula before he brought his published final version out. And there are some differences that play into this. To counter your point, I would say that if you didn't feel like that research or that information provided enough colored your kind of interpretation of or whatever of the novel that has been published that we know of, then I can see the difference in Powers of Darkness, that story that came out. And I can also say that from a writer who has to do research for your works, that means he did an excellent job, because you don't want the research to be on the surface. You want it to be as far back. You want it to feel like he didn't have to do any research at all. And if you read the novel and you're like, I don't feel like the historical figure really kind of affected the character.
To be clear, what I'm saying is I don't believe that the historical figure has symbolic weight in the themes that Stoker is playing with. Although I do think that the historical figure molds the character that we know, right? And some of the character's proclivities.
Right. And I think there are, especially with good works of literature, there are primary things that as writers we set out to think about, why am I telling this story, right? And then there are secondary and subsurface themes that kind of sprout up as we're telling the story. And I would think that the historical figure plays with some of these subsurface themes and some of these basic ideas, because this idea of names, this idea, he doesn't go very much into, in Dracula itself, into this, like talk about ancestry and like the, I mean, he does a little bit. He talks about ancestry.
Yeah, there is some talking about him. No.
But if it's to be believed that Powers of Darkness is written off of an older version of this book, then he goes much deeper into it in an original, in an earlier draft that he eventually cuts out. Because I'll spoil this for you. Powers of Darkness changes the story so much because Harker going to Transylvania and being with Dracula and interacting with him takes about 2/3 of the book. Whereas,
oh wow, it's only about 1/3 in the other novel,
right? And the rest of the stuff of the other novel is shortened to like the last 1/3 of the book.
Interesting.
So there's a lot more of him playing with the Count and learning who the Count really is in Powers of Darkness. Yeah. And if that was written from an earlier version of, then yeah, the historical figure would play a much bigger role in the story.
That would make a lot of sense.
But I think too, I do think it would play with those themes. I think it would affect them greatly. I mean, especially when we think of these ideas, I mean, we're coming from, you know, three white guys sitting here talking about these things. We're coming from this kind of, you know, this British lineage or this Western European lineage.
In my case, literally British lineage.
Literally British lineage.
Nobody knew I was white until you said that.
They couldn't tell, Curtis.
I could have been anyone.
They couldn't tell from your voice. Or that long blonde hair. You know, that was...
Oh, come on. You're dropping the curtain. Yes.
But we have to understand that they would have seen the Romanians just as Eastern as they would have seen, you know, like... Turkish. I mean, they would see them as this like a darker Eastern kind of.
Yeah, I do want to bring. I think we're seeding the conversations for the conversation we really want to have in the next episode.
I think we are.
Yeah, there's something to dig in for.
Yeah,
for
I mean, and I'll leave you with this because I don't want to spoil everything, but I'll leave you with this. Let's look at the first major victim of Dracula once he gets to Britain. What is Lucy's last name?
I don't remember.
Westerna.
Ah, interesting.
And in Powers of Darkness, her last name is just shortened to Western.
Fascinating. All right.
So it's this idea of the East invading the West. And they're the historical figure, I think.
That makes a lot more symbolic resonance, for sure.
All right, everybody. I want to thank our producers. I want to thank my co-hosts for listening to me prattle on about this for hours and hours and hours.
That was great.
I want to thank for all of you who sat through this and could get through the squeamish parts. This was, I think, our most gruesome episode.
It's pretty bad.
It got pretty rough for about 45 seconds. It was like really,
it was, but hey, we're talking about horror. So
we made it.
If we can. If you're not doing so already, follow us on social media. We want to thank our supporters on Patreon. We have our anthology out now. We have our first novel out now. We've got submissions page up for 2022, so you know what we're looking for. Please don't send us, please pay attention to our submission dates. We're going to be at StokerCon. At least one of us will be. I would like the others to go, but they're all just like shunning me. And you know. Other than that, I want to thank you all for listening. So we'll see you next week.